The New Year looks at the old. A review of memorable events in New Zealand during 1948. When the old year's come to an end and the new year's just beginning, when you're looking forward hopefully, almost excitedly to the days ahead, do you take stock as well of the 12 months that lie behind you? Of the friends you've made, the places you've been, the shows you've seen, the things you've read? Of course you do. Many of your memories will be yours and yours alone, but many more are common to us all. To recall the headline news from overseas can do little but leave a bitter taste in the mouth. War in Palestine, war in China, war in Malaya, starvation in Europe, the wrangling of diplomats and the numbed resignation of the common man. All these things and 100 more merge into a tangled scene of misery and despair. Now for one day at least, let's turn our backs, shut our minds to the outside world, and think about the one place that's more important to us than any other, New Zealand.
For the province of Otago, more than for any other part of New Zealand, the year 1948 was a memorable one. 100 years before, the first immigrant ships, John Wycliffe and Philip Lang, had dropped anchor in Port Chalmers Harbour. The Scotsmen on board had set out from a country overrun by poverty and distress to found a new Edinburgh, where they could enjoy a healthy climate and freedom for worship, education, and leisure. Throughout 1948, their descendants celebrated their landing with all kinds of ceremonies and festivities. One of the first of these was a reenactment of the first landing, during which the speech made by the emigrants' leader, Captain Cargill, was spoken just as it had been 100 years before.
It is a fact that the eyes of the British Empire, and I may say of Europe and America, are upon us. The rulers of our great country have struck out a system of colonization on liberal and enlightened principles. And small though we now are, we are the precursors of that first settlement which is to put that system to the test. Our individual interests are therefore bound up with a great public cause.
The centennial celebrations in Dunedin were a useful reminder to other New Zealanders that many of our most successful countrymen in the fields of science, culture, learning, commerce, and administration are associated with the pioneer settlement in Otago.
In the first month of 1948, too, something of a very different nature from celebrations occurred. Numbers of children were falling victim to poliomyelitis. It was thought that to open schools would be asking for trouble. And so at the end of January, the Honourable Mr. McCombs made an announcement to parents, children, and teachers.
The 1948 school year is beginning, but as you all know, it is under unusual circumstances. The decision of the government to postpone the opening of the schools until after Easter to prevent the spread of poliomyelitis means that the schools will remain empty, but that every home where there are children of school age will become a miniature school. That this must affect the normal routine of most households will be obvious to everyone, but the danger of a deadly epidemic must be met. And at a time like this, the health of our children must be the first consideration. It is my concern as Minister of Education to see that the formal education of our children is interrupted as little as possible during this emergency. And I wish to explain to you tonight exactly what steps are being taken so that this year's schoolwork can begin. Most of you know something of the Education Department's Correspondence School, which, through postal lessons, teaches children who live far from any school or who, through some physical handicap, are unable to attend school.
Those of you with children will remember how well the scheme did work. Lessons and broadcasts coming and going with the regularity of clockwork. But mothers, perhaps, remember equally vividly how pleased they were to see the children go off to school again.
In February, apart from the 29th, which is very important to people celebrating their spouse birthdays on that date, and young ladies wishing to take advantage of the leap year rule, one of the most interesting events was the arrival of Lady Baden-Powell in New Zealand. Guides and brownies, wildly excited, of course, turned out in full force all over the country to see their chief and hear her encouraging words about the guide movement.
Yes, it has been my task, my duty, and my privilege to serve the guide movement, which was founded by my husband very soon after he had invented and founded the Boy Scouts. The inspiration which created these two associations both catches and holds those of us to whom it sounds its clarion call, and up and down the length and breadth of the whole wide world, scouting and guiding demands full measure of one's thought and effort, if it is to be developed wider and further, and to take its full share in the full promotion of good in the melting pot of world conditions today. It has been built up by the high-minded efforts of hundreds of thousands of fine people who have seen the vision of the good that the movement can do and the happiness that it can bring to the young people for whom guide training was devised. And I find that there is never an idle moment or an hour's time to be wasted, for the game of guiding demands vigorous leadership and has now risen to a status which merits due support. In its early days, the movement was counted lightheartedly as a rather vague and somewhat unusual occupation just for the children, just to keep them out of mischief, and only to be indulged in, perhaps by an enthusiastic few. But the passing of the years has altered all that. The care and the leadership of young people of this generation has become the concern of every thinking man and woman, and the right influences and uplifting training for body, mind, and soul are more needed now in the world than ever before. And it is for this heartening business that scouting and guiding was designed, and for which it has proved its value in full measure. The acid test of two wars, and the unsettled periods of peace between, have shown that the guide system and activities are full of interest for the young, that the ideas within the movement are acceptable to old and young alike, and that its ideals are revered and embraced by peoples of all races, religions, and nationalities.
Early in March, the announcement that Their Majesties the King and Queen and the Princess Margaret were to visit New Zealand in 1949 was the signal for tremendous activity on the part of government officials, city councils, painters, gardeners, manufacturers, cleaners, and dozens of other people interested in seeing that New Zealand should look its best for such a great occasion. And it was a great occasion, for not yet in the history of our dominion has the reigning sovereign paid us a visit. Here was an opportunity for Maori and Pākehā alike to express their loyalty to the throne. The king is our king not by external authority, but because we wish it to be so. And for that reason, we wanted to see him and the Queen and Princess Margaret, not merely in photographs and print, but actually before our eyes.
You'll not need much reminding of another announcement made by the acting Prime Minister on November the 23rd, that because of the King's poor health, the royal tour had to be cancelled. We were greatly disappointed, of course, but more than that, we felt concern and sympathy for the King himself. We hoped that before long he'll be well enough again to pay us the visit we've looked forward to so much.
Perhaps because of the expected visit by the King and the Queen, we all took particular interest in another royal event, their silver wedding, celebrated in April with the pomp and colourful ceremony usual on such great occasions. Although far from New Zealand, it stirred the minds and imagination of New Zealanders almost as much as if it had been happening in their own hometown, and such is their affection for the royal family.
Back in New Zealand, on the last day of April, Narahoe started to erupt, not a very important phenomenon in itself, though quite spectacular, but watched with interest by most people, because you never know with volcanoes, do you?
May the 18th, the Parliamentary Committee of Inquiry into the Film Industry opened, watched more closely than any volcano by members of the industry, and ordinary filmgoers were intrigued too, to see the works behind their favourite entertainment laid bare for analysis. People living in the Wairarapa are not likely to forget the same month of May either. Their lands and homes disappeared from sight under the swirling, muddy waters of one of the worst floods they'd had.
On April the 25th, one of the year's most distinguished visitors, Lord Beveridge, spoke to us.
Nearly 150 years ago, the poet Wordsworth wrote, "We must be free or die, who speak the tongue that Shakespeare spake, the faith and morals hold which Milton held." You who are listening, and I who am talking, alike use Shakespeare's tongue as our birthright. Let us think tonight of what we mean by the liberty, which alone for all of us makes life seem worth living. There are some things about which there's no room for debate. We should all agree that there are essential citizen liberties without which we are not free at all. These include the personal liberties, freedom of worship and conscience, freedom of speech, writing, study, and teaching, freedom of spending a personal income, or at least as much as the tax collector leaves to us. They include certain political liberties, in particular freedom to associate with others for public purposes, to form trade unions, friendly societies, political parties, and so on. All this can be accepted without discussion. There are other points well worth discussing, because in regard to them, there have been differences of view and a notable development of thought since 150 years ago. Like all vital ideas, this idea of liberty changes and develops with changing circumstances. It is dynamic, not static. When Wordsworth wrote, and for one or two generations after, liberty in Britain meant, in the main, freedom from the arbitrary power of autocratic government. Defense of liberty meant, on the one hand, restricting the sphere of government, and on the other hand, replacing autocracy by democracy, so as to prevent any necessary use of power.
Lastly, in a month of varied events, the Irish politician Eamon de Valera arrived in New Zealand on a goodwill tour. Before leaving, he spoke over the radio, and this is part of what he said.
In bidding goodbye to New Zealand, my colleague, Mr. Aiken, and I would like to say how much we enjoyed our visit and how grateful we are for the generous hospitality extended to us by the government and for the courtesy and kindness shown to us by everybody, and especially by the state officials so generously assigned to us. As I said on my arrival, we were particularly anxious to visit New Zealand. We knew that for a century, a large number of our people had made New Zealand their home, had loved it, and become its devoted citizens, and had contributed their full share in making New Zealand the envied land it is today. We had heard of the richness of New Zealand's resources, of the fertility of its soil, of its wonderful climate, and of the variety and beauty of its scenery. Above all, we had heard of New Zealand's achievements as a valiant pioneer in the field of social endeavor, striving to provide that the individual citizen, who in full liberty plays his due part in the community effort to reach higher and nobler standards, will find in the community.
The first names appearing in the month of June were Anne Ziegler and Webster Booth, a singing team whose concerts and recordings have entertained people all over the world. And then came the Ballet Rombert. If you're a ballet man, you'll remember them more clearly than anything else during the year. They were a thrill, weren't they? First-class ballet is pretty scarce out here, and to be able to see a company so widely praised and publicized overseas was something we're not likely to forget in a hurry. Carmen was in full swing at Dunedin then, too. Many a member of the New Zealand forces had had a taste of grand opera in Italy during the war, found it good, and wanted more. New Zealand has enjoyed few visits from full-scale companies, and so Bizet's Carmen, with Janet Howe and Arthur Servant, imported from England, attracted thousands of people, interested to see what could be done in a predominantly local production. With the arrival of the English pianist Moira Limpany, July carried on the musical interest of June. A good many of us had already heard her recordings, but to hear an artist recorded can't be compared with hearing a live performance. Moira Limpany lived up to our highest expectations. And so too did our own Richard Farrell, out here on a concert tour. After we'd heard him in recitals and playing with the National Orchestra, we could tell that here was another New Zealander on the way to international fame in the world of music. Then, at the end of the month, one of the most wonderful people ever to have visited us arrived. Helen Keller. Perhaps it would be fairer to say two of the most wonderful people, for without the sympathetic companionship of Polly Thompson, Helen Keller would be lost. To hear what this woman, blind and deaf almost from birth, has done is almost unbelievable.
Helen Keller has lectured in every one of the United States, in Canada, in England and Scotland, even in Yugoslavia. In 1937, at the request of the Japanese government, she did a 3 months lecture tour of Japan, Korea, and Manchukuo. She has acted in vaudeville and appeared in a movie which was made of her life. She has her own way of appreciating music. She listens with her fingers on the instrument. She listens to the radio by placing her fingers lightly on a sounding board made of balsa wood. She can tell whether one or more instruments are playing, and very often she can even tell what the instruments are. She goes to the movies and the theater with Miss Thompson, who taps into her hand the story that is being told on stage or screen. Among her friends, she has numbered many of the world's great people: Dr. Alexander Graham Bell, Andrew Carnegie, Charlie Chaplin, Theodore Roosevelt, Henry Ford, Woodrow Wilson are among them, and Mark Twain, who said that in his view, the most interesting characters of the 19th century were Napoleon and Helen Keller. Her sense of smell is extremely acute. "Walking along a street," she says, "I recognize perfumes, powders, creams, choice flowers, and pleasant exhalations from the houses. I can smell delicate food, silken draperies, and rich tapestries. Sometimes, when a door opens as I pass, I know what kind of cosmetics the occupants of the house use. I know if there's an open fire, if they burn wood or soft coal, if they roast their coffee, if they use candles, if the house has been shut up for a long time, if it's been painted or newly decorated, and if the cleaners are at work in it. I know when I pass a church and whether it is Protestant or Catholic." Helen Keller has been the subject of much scientific experimentation. As she puts it, "I wonder if any other individual has been so minutely investigated as I've been by physicians, psychologists, physiologists, and neurologists. To scientists, I am something to be examined like a sunspot or an atom. They bring all kinds of instruments with long Greek names and strange shapes and appalling ingenuity." Much has been written about her, and much more will be. But as the celebrated philosopher William James says of Helen Keller, "The sum of it is that you are a blessing, and I'll kill anyone who says you are not."
In August, Cicely Courtnage burst upon us. Her voice is as well known to most radio listeners as the voices of their own relations. But although we were aware of her personality in her recordings, most of us were still staggered at her amazing energy and vivacity. Remember her singing this song?
Sing, brother, and sing, sister, we're all leaving today. And we'll all go riding on the rainbow to a new land far away.
We received news on August the 12th that the British Empire Games are to be held in New Zealand in 1950. That was a day for the sportsmen, if you like, but what a rift in the loot it caused. Christchurch confidently expected to have the honour of holding the Games there in Canterbury's centennial year. Auckland equally sure that the right was hers. Drawn daggers, rude remarks, appeals. Finally, Auckland the victor and the sound of gnashing teeth in the south.
All that was left completely in the shade on the 19th, though, by Mr. Nash's sensational announcement at the close of the budget speech. the New Zealand pound was to return to parity with the pound sterling. The spectacular bridging of the gap between the two pounds secured for Mr. Nash's budget statement more notice overseas than has ever previously been given to an item of New Zealand financial news. Mr. Nash claimed that the change would mean a substantial reduction in the cost of imported raw materials and other commodities, as well as farmers' and manufacturers' costs. One London newspaper remarked, "The city is stunned by the news," and reactions have ranged from jubilation to violent complaints.
This demonstration of the power of finance was followed a few days later by an equally awe-inspiring demonstration of the power of nature. A fierce tornado struck Frankton and left a trail of damage behind it. Winston McCarthy was there to give an eyewitness account of the disaster.
Hello, everyone. Following lightning and thunder and heavy rain, at 20 minutes to 12 this morning, a cyclone struck Hamilton, not actually in the town, but more in Frankton. The first indication that anything was amiss was a roaring sound, rather terrifying, and it was as if one were in a wind tunnel. And then the cyclone struck for almost 2 minutes. Then the air was filled with flying corrugated iron, trees and other debris. And when the cyclone had passed, there was a scene of desolation for about 100 yards wide on the Hamilton side of the railway line and to the left of the post office. Now, I will quote from the Waikato Times. "The business section of Franklin was seriously damaged. There were numbers of weaker buildings absolutely torn to pieces. And up over the hill into Hamilton West and across the river to Hamilton East, there's a trail of damage, including chimneys torn down, houses unroofed, trees uprooted, and, of course, power and telephone wires just in a tangle in the streets. It is said that the cyclone originated in the Franklin or Forest Lake area. It whirled across the business area of Frankton, and it passed between the lake and Victoria Street and across to Hamilton East, where damage was done in Wellington, Naylor, and Grey Streets in particular. Frankton, of course, suffered most, and it was here that the three victims were killed. In Collingwood Street, an aged bedridden patient had the roof torn off her house, and she was struck and injured on the head by a falling wardrobe. In Hamilton West, havoc was wrought in all streets in the vicinity of Tower Hill. Numbers of roofs were lifted off bodily. Chimneys crashed down and flying debris, often to considerable distance, smashed other roofs and windows. The air was filled with flying iron, with branches of trees and timber and other debris. It was all accompanied by heavy rain, and the storm, as I said, created a roaring noise which was terrifying even to those outside the comparatively narrow strip immediately affected. The sudden descent of this cyclone, the tearing noises, and the flying debris threw hundreds of households into panic. Children especially were, of course, very frightened, and it was made worse by the rain pouring into damaged houses, and over it all, lightning flashed and the thunder boomed. It passed very quickly, and was succeeded then by a very strange calm. Now, in Queen's Avenue in Frankton, a house was lifted bodily across the street, which gives some indication of the severity of the damage in many other parts of the town. In another place, there was a big blue gum, and it was just torn in half as if with a giant knife. We saw telephone poles leaning at drunken angles, and I myself just missed the centre of it by 30 seconds. Two of the New Zealand selectors, Norman McKenzie and Harold Strang, and myself, had been out to Karapiro. We just passed through the main street in Frankton by 30 seconds when the cyclone struck. There was a corrugated iron flew all around our car, and we were very, very fortunate indeed that we were not there. But it is really a scene of desolation with houses in one street in particular. There's just nothing left of them. They've just absolutely ripped to pieces. Nevertheless, the authorities were quickly on the scene, and we had all of the post and telegraph people and the electricity departments out looking after the wires. However, everything is now, order is being made out of chaos. The streets are swept of the glass, but there is one peculiar thing in where it did strike severely. We would see one shop with the roof torn off, all of the glass broken in all of the windows, saddening sight, while shops next door had not even something knocked off the windows.
So much for the Frankton tornado. September the 1st dawned on a large number of radio listeners who'd woken up to find their favorite radio stations in the wrong places on the dial.
The frequencies had been changed, of course. But so many of us are creatures of habit that, sure enough, we'd forgotten. However, after a few days of disturbed listening, we all settled down again. It gave everyone something to talk about for a while, though, didn't it? And while we're on the subject of broadcasting, it's as well to remember that on September the 27th, Radio New Zealand came on the air for the first time. Its purpose? To give a program to the South Pacific area, including Australia, and to build up our goodwill overseas. Contrary to expectations, people in many parts of New Zealand found that they could tune into the programs too, and they soon became familiar with the tuning signal, the call of the Tui.
With the arrival in New Zealand of the Old Vic Company on September the 6th, began a visit we can look back on as the biggest event in New Zealand theatrical history. Of course, everyone knew what Sir Laurence Olivier looked like from his appearances in a number of outstanding films, and the same applied to his equally famous wife, Vivian Leigh. So that naturally, we were more than eager to see what they looked like in the flesh. Every performance of the Old Vic Company was packed. Audiences were wildly enthusiastic. Most of them hadn't seen production so polished and so thoroughly satisfying before. Those who could get in, that is. The struggle for seats was grueling. Marathon queuing, such as we'd never seen before, was common, and by the time booking offices opened, queues presented an extraordinary spectacle. Tents, chairs, camp stretchers, cushions, primus stoves were littered for yards, the jaded proprietors sitting about unshaven or unmade up, all waiting patiently. That's an experience they won't forget in a hurry.
Sir Laurence Olivier made his attitude to the public and to the Old Vic Company quite plain at the civic reception given to the company when it first arrived in Auckland.
Your Worship, Mr. Mayor, Madam Maris, ladies and gentlemen, elders of this fair city, it is an extreme and very real pleasure to us to be with you today. It is something that we've looked forward to for a very long time. Coming to New Zealand. I would like to say that we have been given so much reason to wish to come for the last few years of our lives particularly. And it has been our very deep anxiety to somehow get here and to touch the hand that had been outstretched to us in such noble and everlasting generosity. We come with the Old Vic Theatre Company. That is really the most important part of that phrase. The Old Vic Theatre Company is not a company surrounding two, shall I say, stars. It is a company that is a unity in itself, and that is the whole point of it. That is why we love it, because we show you some plays performed by a complete, whole, solid, unity, a company. That is what we try to sell the idea of. In these days, when there are very few dramatists writing for us, we have to try and promote an interest in the art of acting, because acting, by turns, takes a major place in the art of the theatre from time to time. That is for want of a better theatre. I suppose perhaps a better theatre might be an author's theatre. When we had so many authors, we didn't know what we were going to do with them. But as it is at the moment, for want of a better, the theatre belongs to the actors. Therefore, our great joy is to try and interest the public all over the world in the art of acting. To do that, we believe in the ascension of the company as against the ascension of separate people.
At 7:30, on the cold, wet morning of October the 16th, Sir Laurence Olivier, spectacular to the last, was hoisted in a sling on board the Corinthic to the sound of clicking cameras and popping flashlights. He and the Old Vic Company took with them the best wishes of all the New Zealanders who had been so thrilled by their plays.
The outstanding sporting events of 1948 came in a bunch in October and November. The first was the North-South football match in Wellington on the 2nd of October. Partisan spirit ran high, and in addition, everybody watched it with interest because of the clinching effect it had on the selection of a team to tour South Africa. There's not much need to remind you that the team was finally decided on within an hour of the end of the game. You remember those last breathless minutes as the North battled to make up lost ground?
South 12, North 11, there's only 2 minutes to go. In it goes, and it goes out to the North. And Allen gets it, and Allen has to left foot it to prop. Four touch on this side. Yes, into touch it goes, about 10 yards outside the 25-yard mark. Waiting for the throw-in. Cutting, throwing in. Got them all right. In it goes, jump high. Henderson Gordon took that ball, but it was stopped from going back for one of the South Island forwards. Down they go into one of those inevitable rucks. Tight ones there, you know, they all drop over the top of each other. The referee's looking for it. Scrum it there, he said. 10 yards from the sideline. South 12, North 11. And the Savage to put it in. 12 yards outside his 25 and 10 yards from the strand stand. Touch a penalty to the North. And the crowd cheer. Scott will have a go into the wind, but I don't think he's got a show. He's going to have a go. He's going to take it halfway between the 25 and halfway. He's got a southerly wind to kick into. He's taking it 10 yards from this grandstand touchline. If you remember, it was at the same stage last year that John Kelly had a shot at goal right on time for South Island and put it under the bar. And this will have to be a real miracle kick to go over into this southerly breeze. It's blowing very, very strongly. He's taking it from halfway between the 25 and halfway, 10 yards from the sideline, but it's the type that you must have a go at to have a go to win the match, because it's the only show. He's kicked it, no. In front of the post, it's going to drop. Jack Goddard takes it, and he moves across this way. He's going to kick for touch. Peter Henderson looking for it, but he'll find touch. Scott's in touch. Scott goes for a quick throw in. Throws it straight in, into Johnston. And Johnston puts a left footer into it, and it's in touch now. That's R.D. Johnston. Time almost up, 5-6 yards outside the 25. South 12, North 11, wait for it. In it goes, and it's taken offside. Referee said offside, Peter Johnston. And Scott's going to have another shot, exactly the same place. Exactly the same place. He's going to have another pop. Wind's almost a gale force now. It has been for quite a while past there, and although it would be a great thing for Scott to kick a goal like this, I wish he could only get 1 point for it and make it a draw, if he did get it. Because it's been a grand game, very, very hard indeed. Now, Scott's kick this time. No, it's held up in the wind, straight in front of the post. And Grant dives for it. Now all the forwards are up on top of the South Islanders. Elvis has got it. And they've got him. Can't get it out. Bob's racing back to get into position. He was in there too, trying to get it. There'll be a scrum here, I think. Well, they're going in there like nothing on earth. But it comes out to Savage. And Savage gives it to Botting. And Botting will kick for touch. And this will be it. It's over. The South Island defeat the North by 12 points to 11 at Athletic Park.
Then at the end of October came the New Zealand Trotting Cup, won by the now-celebrated Highland Fling, who at the same time put up a world's record time of 4 minutes, 10 and 3/5 seconds.
It's Van der Bar on the inside and single direct on the outside with 3 furlongs left to travel, and these two have cleared out from the field. And the 5 length here is Spray Man, and there's Highland Fling going right into third place and travelling fast, Spray Man, and Highland Fling is within 3 lengths the leader as they come round towards the two. And they've got 2 furlongs left to go, and it's Van der Bar on the inside from single direct on the outside. And Highland Fling is pacing nicely on the fence, just a length away and in behind the two of them. 3 lengths to Spray Man, then in the mood on the inside of Knave of Diamonds, followed by Emilis and Dundee Sand, then they swing for home. And it's Thunderbar by a length from single direct, and Highland Fling is challenging on the other. Tennis Harlem Fling on the outside from Thunder Bar and single direct, and Harlem Fling is doing the better of the three, I do believe. And Harlem Fling will win the New Zealand Trotting Cup from 1948 and win it like a champion by 3 lengths from Thunder Bar, 3/4 of a length to single direct. And 4 lengths further back, we've got Neighbor Diamonds and Royal Nurse together, followed by Stray Man on the outside of Dundee Sandy. Then 10 lengths to Navigate, 2 lengths to Emulus, 5 lengths to In the Mood, 4 lengths to Loyal Peter, and 6 lengths to Abba Hall. There it is, the New Zealand Trotting Cup of 1948, and won by the champion Highland Fling. Made no race of it at all, trailed the leaders, returned for home, ran up on the outside with a furlong to go, and played with the opposition. Number 14 wins Highland Fling, right?
After that race, Highland Fling made further trotting history by equaling and then breaking the New Zealand mile record.
In another category altogether, but just as spectacular, the severe floods in Clutha in the first week of November caused widespread interest and sympathy. It's pretty hard to realize what it's like having your home and land submerged by floodwaters unless you've actually suffered it yourself. But newspapers and radio gave us a fair idea of what the unfortunate people in that district were going through.
And from here, I have a bird's eye picture of the Clutha River in flood. From where I'm standing, I can see a turbulent mass of swift, muddy water flowing down towards the Balclutha Bridge. Right out in front of me, there are several houses which have been isolated by this water, completely surrounded by the river, and also a row of poplar trees standing out alone in the middle of this expanse of turbulent water. And a little way ahead of me, there's the stop bank, in which the men are feverishly engaged in filling sandbags with earth in an effort to stop the water from seeping through the banks and causing further damage. Just at the back of the recording truck here, several lorries waiting to be loaded up with clay and earth, and they'll make their way down to the stop bank. But as I said before, it's quite a terrific mass of water sweeping down very swiftly, and if the banks hold and stop the seepage, I think everything's going to be all right.
And it was all right. But everyone had had a trying time until the water went down and the danger was past.
A couple of radically different types of ship were in the news early in December. After months of work, the Wanganella at last floated again on the Wellington Harbour, and the Pamio was handed back to Finland by the New Zealand government. But all this was very small beer compared with the news of November the 15th, the birth of a son to Princess Elizabeth. Here was an event of worldwide interest and far-reaching importance. New Zealanders took a warmly personal interest in a child who, although 12,000 miles away, would probably one day be their king.
Now the weeks have gone by. Christmas has come and gone, and we're back at the beginning again. New Year's Day, 1949. The things that happened in 1948 are fading fast from our memories, and our thoughts are of the future. The curtains of yesterday drop down, and the curtains of tomorrow roll up before us.